UK Wine Show, show number 17. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 17 for the 22nd of September. My name's Chris Scott, and this show is brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. This week we're talking to Richard Holstead from Wine Intelligence. Richard and I discussed some issues such as the high levels of alcohol in wine and whether people out there are enjoying that. And also we touched on the screw cap and how that's been perceived in the UK market as well. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. As we head out of summer, there's news that white wine might be as good for our hearts as we've been told that red wine is. Previous research put the grape's heart-healthy benefits down to antioxidant compounds found in their skins. When making red wine, these are crushed along with the grape pulp, but they're separated out when making white wine. However, the study suggests that grape flesh may be equally beneficial. The research was conducted by scientists from the United States and Italy, and a further study is now needed to identify exactly what it is in grape flesh that is good for our hearts. Meanwhile, one English wine grower has found a way around the vagaries of our weather by putting his vines under glass. The extensive glass housing at Strawberry Hill Vineyard in Gloucestershire enables Tim Chance to successfully grow better-known red grape varieties, which don't normally thrive here. Tim told us that the benefits of greenhouses include a much longer growing season as well as a more moderate and controlled climate for the grapes. The vineyard won't be in full production for another 3 years, but its wine list already features a Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon blend, a Pinot Noir and a Chardonnay. And over in China, the 11th largest wine producer in the world, they're going to start making ice wine. Changyu, the country's biggest wine producer, is to use the technical expertise of the Canadians to help it build what is expected to be the largest ever ice wine estate. Ice wine is made by picking grapes late in the season when they are shriveled up and have frozen to produce highly concentrated juice. Currently, only Canada, Germany and Austria produce this premium quality dessert wine, so supply falls far short of demand. Changyu is hoping that it will be able to double the amount of ice wine that is made. That's it for this week. Back over to you, Chris.
Thanks, Jane, for that. Quite interesting about China being the 10th largest producer of wine in the world. We don't normally associate China with producing wine, but being 10th largest producer, it makes them bigger than New Zealand and a lot of other countries. Perhaps it's because we don't see a lot of Chinese wine on our shelves, and it's mainly for the domestic market. But they're doing a lot of planting at the moment, so they will eventually start exporting their wine. And there's no reason why they shouldn't. You know, China spans the 30, 50 degree latitudes quite nicely, so there's some regions that can produce some good wine there. The other interesting bit in the news was about the Merlot grapes being grown by Strawberry Hill Vineyards. I understand that Three Choirs, also in Gloucestershire, are also trying to grow Cabernet Sauvignon grapes under glasshouse as well for their local restaurant goers. Be interesting to see how that goes. Eventually, hopefully, though, one day with a bit of global warming, we may not need hothouses to grow those sort of grapes. That ends the news. Let's have a listen to the interview with Richard.
Hi, I'm with Richard Halstead from Wine Intelligence. Wine Intelligence do a lot of consumer research. Part two of this two-part series, I thought we'd look at a bit about the consumer. I wanted to touch on a couple of areas, particularly the alcohol level in wine and screw caps, just to see what you've learned from consumers in your research. Let's start off with alcohol. It's always a good one to do with wine. A lot of wines these days, the alcohol levels have been drifting up, even in Bordeaux nowadays. How are the consumer dealing with that?
Well, generally, they think, whoopee.
Yeah.
Think, wow, I'm getting, you know, more bang for my buck. You know, the vast majority of consumers, it would appear, welcome the idea of, you know, higher alcohol wines. By higher alcohol, we're talking, you know, over 13%. So sort of 13, 14, 15 degrees. But there is obviously still a minority of people who resent higher alcohol wines and actually strongly prefer and advocate wines with lower alcohol levels. If you were to characterize the, you know, who's doing this, what you generally see is there is a correlation between age and preference for lower alcohol wines, although it's not a terribly strong correlation. So
the older people prefer the lower alcohol?
Yeah, yeah, and younger people prefer higher alcohol.
Is it a sweetness thing? Because I understand, or a few people have told me in the past, that as you get older, your taste buds change and you prefer sweeter, you become less sensitive to other things, but sweetness you can keep track of. So people, as they get older, prefer sweeter products, and higher sweetness means normally less alcohol. You swap between alcohol and sweetness. Is that it, or is it...
The fact is, Chris, I don't know the answer. And I think this is an area that, frankly, we need to do a lot more work in to understand the difference between the taste perceptions of older people versus younger people. I think at this stage in the game, I think there's a far more mundane reason why younger people tend to like higher alcohol wines more than older people, which is that older people don't like hangovers as much and certainly tend to have hangovers that last longer than, you know, people in their 20s and 30s. So, you know, that sort of practical reasoning tends to run through why people prefer lower alcohol wine as well if you look at the gender split, because albeit that there isn't, again, a very strong correlation, there is a slight indication that women prefer lower alcohol wine and men prefer higher alcohol wine. And I think that's mainly to do with sort of being able to hold your drink. And, you know, if you have, as I'm sure you have done, and your listeners, gone into a pub and ordered a glass of the Chardonnay, and you'll tend to get a 250ml glass, which is a third of a bottle. And if that Chardonnay happens to be, you know, the full-on 14% alcohol version, you drink two glasses of that. You've drunk two-thirds of a bottle of 14-degree alcohol Chardonnay, which is the equivalent of probably over a bottle of 12-degree wine. And, you know, you've only had two glasses and you're still in the pub and it's probably still, you know, before 8 o'clock in the evening on a Saturday. And, you know, you're three sheets to the wind. And there's a clear feeling among some consumers that that's perhaps not the place they want to be. So they'd rather drink, you know, something that's a bit lower in alcohol that they can enjoy for longer, and then not sort of fall over when they try to stand up.
When I was a student at university, I had a mate who used to drink sherry, and the reason he drank sherry was he worked out the ABV per pound, or in this case, he's dollars, and that was what he chose. Do you think that sort of behaviour is exhibited at all in these people?
Well, about 2 years ago, we did a study for the Wine Trade Action Group, which is a collection of producers and importers in the UK. And they were concerned at the time about the impact of binge drinking legislation, proposed, pending, threatened, on the wine category. And what they wanted to establish was whether wine actually did play a part in people's binge drinking sessions. And the answer was broadly no, because beer and spirits-based drinks are still, you know, the staple of such you know, binge drinking sessions. However, what we did find was two things. One, wine does play a role as a sort of early evening sharpener on the basis mainly of its relative cheapness in terms of how much alcohol it delivers. So this bang for buck thing is present in the UK market when it comes to drinking wine. The other factor was that actually you can, if you're ordering wine in a pub or bar and it's crowded, you can get, you know, a bottle of 14-degree wine, four glasses, much more easily than you can to get four pints of lager, and you can carry it more easily. So, you know, there are clearly a section of the drinking public that have cottoned onto the idea of wine as being quite a sort of efficient buzz creation mechanism, for want of a better expression.
What about the taste? I always find wines with a lot of alcohol often lack acidity. If you're in the trade there, someone might mention the word elegance, which is generally just acidity. There is quite a difference in both flavours and the way the wine feels in your mouth. Lower alcohol wines can often feel a bit lighter in the palate, as opposed to, you know, something, you know, you can imagine a Shiraz at 14-15%. It's quite a full wine. There's lots of weight in there from the alcohol in your palate. Hardly any acidity because they've left the fruit on the vine, so the acidity levels have dropped away. So the wines feel bigger as well. Is there another element, do you think, to this?
I think what you've just described, Chris, is something that probably 99% of consumers would not be aware of or be able to describe.
Not necessarily about describe, but they would notice the flavour in their mouth, or they'll notice that feeling.
Quite possibly, and what you're seeing possibly is a divergence between the majority of people who quite like a sort of quite big, oaky wine, be it red or white, that tends to come with a high level of alcohol these days, be it from Rioja or the New World, and people who are traditionally gone for a sort of lighter, floral, less heavy-tasting wine, who would traditionally buy Riesling from Germany, which, still comes at sort of 10, 11 degrees by and large, or, traditional old world reds and whites, which come in at about 12. I don't know whether they're actually consciously picking that wine because of the taste profile it's offering, but it's perhaps one of the reasons they're going into one camp or the other. Mm. And interestingly, we have noticed that people in focus groups do say now that they track for their own benefit, in other words, as a way of buying wine, they do track the alcohol level on the front.
Yeah, I've spoken to people who say they look for certain alcohol levels.
Yeah, and most of the people we talk to in focus groups say, generally speaking, the more the better. But there is clearly a minority of people who are now saying, actually, the less the better.
Yeah, I think it's a pendulum. Some people are saying in the States that the pendulum's sort of reached its peak in terms of alcohol and it might be starting to swing the other way.
Well, I hope so. I mean, you can't really get much more alcohol level in some of the American Californian products that you see right now. 16% ABV, that's basically fortified wine, isn't it? By some legal definition, I think. How much of that can you enjoy, frankly, in an evening before you start, you get up and then fall down?
Moving on to screw caps. A lot of people, screw caps have been with us now for, what, 4 or 5 years now, haven't they?
Oh, well, at least, yeah.
Initially, I know there was a lot of people thought they were new and they weren't that comfortable with the concept. What are you finding from people these days?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that consumers, in the UK at least, really like natural cork. They don't see a problem with it. And whilst there is some awareness now of the potential for taint to arise or, some kind of oxidation to arise because the closure is somehow inefficient, they haven't necessarily used that information to see cork as being anything other than the right choice for a bottle of wine. And it's a lot less to do with the technical aspect of things and a lot more to do with the ritual of wine drinking. If you open a bottle of wine, you get the corkscrew out, you pop the cork. The sound of the cork popping sort of sets the taste buds going in a lot of people. Absolutely, it's a Pavlovian reaction, which is all to do with the ritual of drinking wine, which is not like the ritual of drinking orange juice. You drink orange juice because you're thirsty and you need something. You drink wine partly because you're thirsty, partly perhaps at the end of the day because you need a drink to calm down because the kids have been screaming in your ear. But mainly it's to do with this sort of mini ceremony, this kind of moment of time that's yours or that yours and your partners or yours and your friends that is just for you. And it's a bit of indulgence. And the cork popping ceremony is part of that. And I think for we as an industry to dismiss that in favour of a technical solution is perhaps, a little bit naive on our part.
Do you have any numbers on people's preferences?
Well, if you ask consumers which they will accept and which they prefer, and we normally lump those two together to say, well, that's an acceptance rate, you're about 95% acceptance rate for natural cork. You've now got about a 50 to 55% acceptance rate for screw cap, up from about 25, 30% 3 years ago. So what you can see is that, screw cap has gone from being, frankly, a pariah in wine terms because it was so closely associated with sort of the cheap, nasty stuff you drank as students and you now, regret, through to something that's, frankly, mainstream acceptable because it's now appearing on some mainstream products that then have very nice wine inside. So this connection between cheap wine and screw caps are now no longer valid.
Do you think there's in the trade, my recommendations to people are if it's a fresh, fruity wine, something to be drunk reasonably early, screw cap's the way to go. If you're going to age the wine, then take the risk with a cork, because of certain oxidisation processes through the cork. Do you think the consumer is aware of the different styles of wine, that there might be a better closure for different styles of wine?
I think you're getting an emerging awareness amongst people who are more involved in wine as consumers with the choices that the producer has made to seal his particular product. I don't think that there's that much awareness, and I don't think, frankly, people care that much. I think there is a convenience aspect to screw caps that people like, and you know, particularly older people that find that cork is a bit of a fiddly thing to do, and women as well, you know, who perhaps don't necessarily have the muscle power to use a waiter's friend and actually extract the cork.
Especially on those plastic corks.
Yeah, and there, you know, there's certainly an emerging sort of feeling that some synthetic cork closures, are quite hard work to open and then and then reclose, yeah, if you happen to be saving the bottle.
The trade seems to be quite keen on screw caps these days. I know I am if I'm at a big shop and I've got hundreds of bottles of wine to open. Is the consumer and the trade in sync with this and on other issues, or is there a gap between knowledge?
There's certainly a perception gap there. I mean, just looking at closures, for instance, you know, the trade takes a very purist, technical approach to sealing of a product, with the view of having the most efficient seal, the most reliable seal, etc., etc. And the perception, by and large, within the UK trade, certainly at the retail buyer level for the last few years, has been that screw cap is the only, or certainly the key closure that's going to offer that level of reliability and efficiency. Now, you know, obviously that opens a whole can of worms, and there are plenty of people that will debate entirely the opposite point of view. But I'm saying that basically that's what the trade conventional wisdom says. What the consumer says is, actually, I quite like opening a bottle of wine with a cork in it. And I suppose that's to your point about, you know, are the trade and the consumers aligned? Well, the answer is actually quite often they're not. And there's, in fact, what we find in our research is quite often there's a huge gap between what the trade thinks and what consumers think.
Like we've talked about screw caps, is there other examples of that?
Well, I think it's most apparent in the kind of knowledge involvement and frankly the sort of how much people care about the category. Most people you talk to in the wine industry are there not because they want to make millions of pounds or dollars or euros. It's because they are passionate about the category, the product, about what they do, and they have a sort of, you know, fundamental enjoyment for the fact that this is a unique product category in the world. It's diverse, it's got many characters in it, and there's just a vast encyclopedia of knowledge that you could potentially learn. But, you know, frankly, it would take you almost a lifetime to learn it. And even then, you'd probably find that it's something that you didn't know. Consumers, on the other hand, you know, range from the people who do treat wine as a sort of PhD subject through to people that, you know, just want a bottle of decent stuff to drink at the end of a workday. And the wine PhD candidates are few and far between. The people who just want a nice bottle of wine to unwind with are far more numerous. And I think where the trade and the consumers diverge is that the trade considers consumers to be people like them, i.e. people who, you know, if they weren't working in the trade would probably be, you know, having a cellar which was catalogued and, you know, having lots of books about wine knocking about the place so that they could refer to them at any one time. And the consumer view, which is, well, this is quite a nice product to have at the end of the day. You know, this is my bottle of wine. It's my me time. You know, whether it's, you know, Chardonnay from the south facing slopes of this little area of the Languedoc, or, you know, from Central Valley of California, is perhaps not that material to them.
Some people might consider it less about the actual product itself, more about the experience or the occasion that you're drinking it.
Yeah, and it's not to say that we should just sort of say, throw up our hands and go, oh, well, that's the way things should be. You know, what we know from the wine category specifically, but also from, you know, pretty much every other product category you look at, the more people care about the product category, frankly, the more money they're willing to spend on it, and the more discerning they will become in terms of what they buy and how they think about it. And if you're, you know, looking to create value as an industry, you create value by giving people experience and potential to increase their knowledge, as well as, you know, quenching their thirst or, you know, filling a need that's perhaps physiological.
Since we're talking about pricing, you know, do you know what the average bottle price is for supermarkets as opposed to something like Majestic, which are considered to be one of the more, not so much more expensive, but sell the highest average price wines?
From what we understand from AC Nielsen, the average price of wine sold in major multiple retailers in the UK right now is about £3.89 mm-hmm. per bottle. And I think the most recent results from Majestic suggested that their average price point is more like £5.50 per bottle. On that basis alone, you have to sort of take your hat off to the Majestic management for creating an offer that gets, you know, people to spend that much more money, and they happen to be buying a case at the same time, which I think is quite a coup for them.
Volume and price, it's brilliant. What about the supermarkets? People sometimes say, oh, the supermarkets don't have the range that they used to. I know my Sainsbury's, they reduced their range a wee while ago. What sort of typical range would a supermarket have?
Well, I'm surprised, to be honest, Chris, that you found that, because if anything, supermarket wine ranges have been increasing in the recent years, and you know, every so often they do take steps to trim them, but actually it's more a question of sort of trying to stop an upward trend. You know, you get big Tesco's now that have maybe 850 SKUs in them. That's stock keeping units, or literally different wine products, which is, you know, quite a phenomenal range of things, given that, you know, even in breakfast cereals, you've maybe got 50 products, and that's, you know, quite a big range. And you go down to, you know, I don't know, soap powder that's got maybe 10. Yeah. So the diversity of range in wine is still absolutely huge. I think the challenge for us, though, is, you know, this £3.89 price that we've managed to maintain. In fact, you know, if you go back 15 years, it was probably about the same. But, you know, that was in 1991 money. We were getting £3.50 or whatever it was. You know, we really haven't moved. So in real terms, you know, the industry is a lot cheaper than it was in terms of what you can buy at the store shelf. You know, you're spending.
The duty's gone up quite a bit. In the last 15 years.
You know, it doesn't take account of the fact that you've got, you know, several large duty increases in there, probably one every year for the last 10 years, and you know, that the price of everything else has pretty much gone up. You know, I think the only other area where we've seen prices fall is actually consumer electronics.
So, what do you think, in real terms, you know, taking into consideration duty and inflation and all that, what do you think prices have dropped since, say, the 1990s?
Well, excluding duty, probably in real terms, prices are somewhere between half and two thirds what they were in 1991. Yeah. So, you know, from the consumer's point of view, you could argue that we in the UK now are in, you know, somewhat of a golden age in terms of wine purchasing, because we have this vast range of products to choose from, probably the best range of wines to choose from in the world today, because we, you know, don't have an indigenous industry that dominates the shelves, so therefore we can choose, frankly, the best from around the world. We have an incredibly competitive retail market where, you know, price is clearly something that is used as a weapon to attract people into stores. And we have, you know, this vast quantity of very good quality wine that you can now pick up for, you know, frankly, the change in your pocket. Mm. And I don't think we've ever seen anything like it before. The question really is, you know, from an industry point of view, how healthy is this long run? And so how long can it continue?
I think we'll wrap it up there, Richard. Just one last wee thing. Do you have a wine tip for us?
Yes, and it's a bit of a controversial one. You know, I'm actually personally quite a big fan of some of the better known brands, not all of them, but some of them. And I suppose the tip would be, don't be afraid of buying a well-known brand, because quite often they're well-known because the quality is better than anyone else's, and it's not because they've, you know, pumped loads of money into advertising or paid people like me loads of money to help them develop products. It's because, you know, fundamentally the guys that make the wine are the best in the world at what they do.
Well, thanks very much, Richard.
Thank you, Chris.
Cheers.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Richard. I think Richard's comments about the trade being a bit disassociated with the general consumer, because I must admit I've always been more interested in the technical aspects of a closure as opposed to maybe the convenience. Next week, we're going to actually start a two-part series on organic wines and biodynamic wines. We're going to be talking to Lance Piggott from Vintage Root, who are an importer of organic and biodynamic wines into the UK. They've been going now for about 20 years. And then the following week, we're actually going to be talking to people behind Robinvale Wines. But until then, cheers and good drinking. UK Wine Show is brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott. The news is read by Jane Scott. Background news research is by Sandra Clements. The music for the UK Wine Show is Griffiths de Jingle 1 by Marcel de la Giartelli and Silence by Italy North.